This is Jim Inkster. Coming today, we'll visit with Michael Vince, senior scientist with the Department of Environmental Quality, and Ann Shaneyfelt, the director of the Louisiana Clean Fuels Coalition. We'll talk about the environment in Louisiana. How are we doing? Obviously, there are some challenges, and how are they being addressed? Also on the show, Don Cashew, the former congressman. He was on the Hill, the U.S. House of Representatives, for all of 8 months before he was unseated in a controversial race with Bill Cassidy. We'll talk with Don Cashew about what he's doing now. He recently retired as the U.S. attorney in this district and is practicing law. And, of course, he spent many years in the Louisiana legislature. Don Cashew with us for much of the hour. But first, the news on 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number outside the area. It is 877-217-5757. You may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. We begin the week with two people on the forefront of the environment in Louisiana, Michael Vince, senior scientist with the Department of Environmental Quality. He's been with the state and DEQ for several decades, and we're glad he's here to impart his wisdom, along with Ann Shaneyfelt, who is the executive director of the Louisiana Clean Fuels Coalition. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Jim.
All right. Well, this is the start of ozone season, or it's about to be. What does that mean?
Well, you know, we've talked about this in the past, and May and June are really the 2 months out of the year that we see about 25% of our ozone exceedance days here in the Baton Rouge region. So it's really important for us to make sure that everybody's aware of what they can do, where to get information, and what kind of personal choices that they might be able to make that would help to keep us from having ozone exceedance days and to keep the area meeting EPA standards.
So about a quarter of the days all year long happen in May and June.
Right. Ozone is formed from two sources, vehicle emissions, where we get nitrogen oxides, mm-hmm. and volatile organic compounds, which are typically those things you think of with paint fumes and organic-type vapors. And those two things in the presence of sunlight form ozone under the right chemical situation. And that happens to be most effective formation during the May and June time period.
Okay, so we have more sunlight in May and June than we do at other times of the year.
That's right. And a lot of things are dependent upon the weather, whether we get rainy days once we get into the July-August pattern and we start to see more rain in the afternoons. It kind of stops the reaction from occurring, and we don't see as many ozone action days there. But they can continue all the way up into October.
You've been with us a few times before, Michael, and we have, of course, talked about environmental challenges we have in this state for many years. How are we doing as far as getting better?
Well, from the Baton Rouge area perspective, we came into attainment with a previous EPA ozone standard. We did that back in 2011. And then EPA lowered the bar for us again. And here we are at the end of 2013. Our data shows that we are again meeting that standard. So the department is working on submitting the right documentation to EPA to get us redesignated back into attainment status, which is really important for us and for our businesses and industry to help us to be able to compete for jobs and things. That's going to be a really good thing for us. However, as you know, EPA will lower that bar again, and we're expecting that there will be an announcement of that later this year, probably around Christmas. And if that happens, then we could see ourselves back on the non-attainment bus once again.
And you're saying that much of the problem is related to vehicle emissions.
About 25% of the NOx emissions, or the nitrogen oxide emissions in our area, are coming from vehicular sources. And a very small percentage actually comes from the regulated industry, or those people that you would typically think of as mm-hmm. the polluters. That makes up that's a very small percentage. Only about 10% come from those sources.
From industry?
That's correct.
10%, which is sizable, but not nearly as much as as vehicles. So have you purchased a Tesla?
No, I personally don't have a Tesla, but we are doing some things. The DEQ has really taken, kind of stepped up to the forefront across the nation, actually, with promoting what's called the Advance Program. And that's designed to help areas that are very close to becoming non-attainment to catalog activities that are going on both in the private and the public sector, see what kind of reductions you're getting. Because, you know, it takes a while. If everybody went out and bought Teslas, it would take a while for that to show up on our monitors and for our values, our you know, monitored values to actually start to go down. And so that's, while that would be helpful, we're looking for projects now that are underway and ongoing that'll get us those reductions that are necessary, keep those areas from becoming non-attainment. And Baton Rouge is doing we're doing the same thing here in this area.
297-5633 if you'd like to join us. Our guests are Michael Vince from DEQ and Ann Shaneyfelt of the Louisiana Clean Fuels Coalition. Now, Ann, you have been working hand in glove with Michael and others at DEQ to make us a better place as far as the environment. What's going on with your group?
Jim, one of the things that we do is we work with fleets and public and private fleets across the state and help them with their conversions to fuels like natural gas, propane, electric, that all have lower emissions and they're cleaner. We just recently celebrated the opening of Cash's Truck Plaza. It's a truck stop electrification where basically the long-haul truckers, instead of idling all night long when they sleep, mm-hmm. you know, to keep their air conditioners running or run the radios, or they can plug into these systems that will allow them to turn off their engines. So it reduces all of that petrol, that diesel mm-hmm. usage, so they're not breathing in the diesel fumes, are able to get a better night's sleep, and it has a huge effect on the air quality in the area and on the health of the drivers. They've estimated that for 1 year, they're going to be reducing toxic emissions by about 1,100 pounds per year. And this is one of the, you know, quickest and easiest ways to remove those toxins from the air.
Well, what about carpooling and things like that? That would seem to help if we had fewer people on the road.
Carpooling, mass transit, cycling, you know, taking your bike to work if you can, all those things will help. We also have anti-idling campaign. We're mm-hmm. working with local area elementary school. So when the parents are waiting in the carpool line, you know, encouraging them to shut the engines off for a little while, working with the bus drivers, getting them to shut the engines off and not to keep that running. And we also encourage people on ozone action days to, instead of going through your drive-through line, maybe go park at the store, park at the fast food restaurant, and walk inside, because all the idling adds up.
Here's a question from Pam asking if electric cars will someday be required. Do you see that day in our lifetime?
I don't know if we'll see that in my lifetime, but, you know, EPA regulates cars and the fuels that go in those cars, and as they continue to come up with different types of gasoline and they get mm-hmm. better with the emission reductions from the vehicles, we are seeing across the board, over time, we see ourselves with continual reductions, you know, from that right. from that whole sector.
Well, Andy Anderson, the financial advisor, was on the show a few days ago, and he drove in here in his $96,000 Tesla, and he says he can go 300 miles with before he needs another charge. Seemed that would be the most efficient way to do it if you could afford the car.
If you can afford the car, and you know, that I think that's the thing we're going to see over time, that the cost for those technologies are going to become, they're going to get cheaper and cheaper as they get in more widespread use.
297-5633 is your number. Now, you have something called EnviroFlash. Tell us about this.
Okay, EnviroFlash is a tool that is offered where you can actually go in and sign up for it. It's free. It will send messages to your smartphone or to your desktop and let you know what the projected air quality is for tomorrow. And those things come out in the afternoons, and that allows you to plan your day if you are someone who has asthma or COPD or some other a respiratory problem where that condition might be exacerbated by higher levels of ozone. That gives you an idea of how to kind of plan your day. And we also have an early alert system before we even notify the public It's mm-hmm. a lower threshold where we tell our industry partners around the area, they do a voluntary thing where they curtail some of their activities for the next day and reschedule things just to help. And, you know, we call a fair number of days, not as many as what we used to. And many of those days do not materialize, which is a really good thing. But you can get to EnviroFlash by going to the DEQ website at deq.louisiana.gov/EnviroFlash. And it's free, and it's available all around the state.
How's Louisiana doing with comparisons nationally as far as ozone attainment and improving the environmental concerns that we have addressed?
Well, we've got the Baton Rouge area that's poised now to come back into attainment with the standards. And so we're really excited about that. We've made tremendous progress over time in this area. But, you know, as EPA lowers that bar, and it's sort of like a limbo bar, when they lower the standard, we have a certain amount of time to get under that bar. And what we're thinking could happen is not only Baton Rouge, but some other areas of the state could find themselves out of attainment with that standard if it goes down too low.
Now, I have a question here about hybrid vehicles from Jody. That's something you've been promoting for some time, isn't it?
Yes, it is. We're finding some of the hybrids for the cost right now don't reduce the emissions as much as, say, actually converting to electric, natural gas, or propane vehicles. But they are a good boost to getting your fuel economy better in your vehicle.
How much of a boost?
It's a little bit. You'll get a couple more miles per gallon per car depending on the vehicle. But I think as the battery technologies continue to improve, we'll find some vehicles that are like, say, the Volt, which are dual fuel, mm-hmm. Are getting to be very popular.
HB in Denham Springs. Good morning, HB. You're on the air with Michael Vince of DEQ and Ann Shaney Felt of the Clean Fuels Coalition.
Good morning. As you can probably tell, I'm kind of up in age. And over many, many years, what do you say to people who have to use their same mechanics over and over and over for their four-wheelers, their outboards, and their vehicles? And the mechanics are telling them that's been around for a long, long time working on a multitude of different cars that ethanol, gasoline, it doesn't say, they don't say shall or may. They say over a period of time, it will definitely ruin your engine and cost you money big time in the future. What do you say to these people? Thank you, sir.
Well, as I mentioned earlier, EPA sets the standards for what goes into those fuels and the formulation for those fuels. And there's been a tremendous amount of effort looking at how ethanol fuel or fuels containing higher levels of ethanol affect the lines and some of the seals and some of the gaskets. And EPA is working really hard on that right now to see what they can do to make some changes to that.
Well, the situation has improved. We see that not only here but in other cities. Los Angeles used to have smog that was intense, 60s and 70s. That is no longer the case. How have the improvements come? What has been the major catalyst?
We have made pretty significant strides in our area getting reductions from industrial sources. You know, you kind of look at the numbers now, the pieces of the pie that come from the petrochemical industry and the refineries, those guys are regulated pretty hard. And we've picked a lot of the low-hanging fruit when it comes to going after emission reductions. And as you start going after additional reductions, if we have to reduce NOx or VOC, those things cost more, and so when you evaluate them on a per ton cost for reductions, those things get very expensive and to implement. And over in the Houston area, we've heard examples of some of these things costing up to $100,000 or $200,000 per ton of reduction.
297-5633, 877-217-5757, inkstershow@wrkf.org. We'll be back to spend a few more minutes with Michael Vince and with Ann Shaney Felt, and we'll hear from Don Cashew, still active in this community now as a lawyer, back in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. A few more minutes with Michael Vince, senior scientist with DEQ, and Ann Shaney-Felt of the Louisiana Clean Fuels Coalition. Veronica in Denham Springs. Good morning, Veronica.
Hi. Do you find that an increase in fuel costs helped to influence drivers' behavior? No one want to advocate more expensive gas, but do you find that it caused people to slow down and maybe buy more efficient vehicles? Thanks.
I believe that's the case. I mean, we've seen when fuel prices were high just a couple of years ago across the nation, we saw that people were trying to do things to reduce the number of trips that they made and trying to, you know, cut their cost as much as they could. And then when things kind of fall back, people get back into their old habits. And that's one of the things that we try to do working with the Baton Rouge Clean Air Coalition and the Capital Region Planning Commission and Clean Fuels is to advocate projects and advocate things that will keep people into the habit. And the ADVANCE program that we've got is really designed to help to do that. And one component of that is what's called the School Flag Program. And I think one of the reasons that the recycling program was so effective, has been so effective, is that we work to teach our kids. And we have a school that is actually going to be participating in that. And I'll let Ann kind of talk about how that school how the school flag program works and what we're trying to get out of it.
Well, the school flag program is probably going to begin next school year. And our first school on board is Buchanan Elementary. And we're working with the Capital Region Planning Commission for the flag program. And when there's a ozone action day, or when they check every day to see what the air quality is, and they'll put that color flag up, so it'll be a visual reminder for everyone there. And we're also going to look into having everyone sign a pledge, you know, all the moms in the carpool line sign a pledge that they'll turn off their vehicles for 5 minutes, and we'll send out educational materials for everyone so they can understand, you know, what the fumes do and how they can help.
Well, we thank you for joining us today. Ann Shaney-Felt of DEQ and Michael Vince, Ann Shaney-Felt of the Louisiana Clean Fuels Coalition and Michael Vince of DEQ, 32 years. Understand you're calling it a day.
I'm planning to by about the end of this year. I think it's kind of time.
Who knows? Maybe the next governor will be calling on you to be the next secretary of DEQ.
Well, you never know.
Well, thank you, sir. Appreciate it. 297-5633 is your number, 877-217-5757, Inkster Show at WRKF.org. Our guests are about to arrive. Mainly it'll be Don Cashew, the U.S. representative from New Roads, who left office in 2009, succeeded by Bill Cassidy, then became U.S. attorney, and now is a lawyer in private practice. And Don, of course, is also a former lawmaker. He spent many years down at the Louisiana State Capitol, where he was a member of the Louisiana House of Representatives from 2000 to 2008. Last time he was on this show, Don Cashew was running for re-election, I believe, and he has entered a new quest in life. That one didn't go as planned, but you seem to have survived okay.
Oh, yes, sir, Jim. Thank you. Thank you for having me here. And yeah, I'm still breathing and still living and enjoying what we're doing now. And had a good opportunity after we lost that race to work at the U.S. Attorney's Office with some great people. I've been pretty blessed, Jim.
Well, you were a congressman for 8 months. Exactly.
Yeah, that's a good estimate. Somebody had 7 months in one of their news columns, and it really made me mad.
Well, yeah, you did serve through January,
kidding.
Right?
Yeah, so. That's right. But it was a short time regardless.
It was a short time, but you wanted to stay.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. I mean, we fought hard to try to win, and but you know those, you know how politics can be, and we lost and had to move on.
Well, the election was unusual by Louisiana standards because that was the one cycle where we had closed primaries.
Yes, sir.
And as a result, a plurality won that election, and Congressman Cassidy, through his media advisors at the time, at that point, George Kennedy was running his campaign, got Michael Jackson to enter the race, and As a result, I think Cassidy got 48, you got 40, and Jackson got 12. His 12 likely would have gone mostly to you. Might have been a different outcome if it had been during the open primary days then and now.
We think we probably could have won had it been, you know, the system that we had before and the system that we have now.
But are there any residual hard feelings?
No, not at all, Jim. I tell my kids all the time, you know, life isn't always fair, and you have to just move on, and you can't be a victim. And so, no, I have no hard feelings. I mean, you know, I certainly will keep it in the back of my mind, you know, when dealing with some of the people. But no, I have no hard feelings whatsoever.
Well, Don Cashew served 8 years in the Louisiana House before he went to the U.S. House, and then he was U.S. attorney, and now he's a lawyer in private practice, so we have a good deal of ground to cover with him. My friend Darren Mann asks, do you receive a pension from your days as a U.S. House member?
Well, everybody knows, Jim, you serve one day and you get, you know, pension for life. No, that is a big myth. You know, I was not eligible because I didn't serve long enough. You basically follow the same rules as all federal employees. I think you have to be in the system for 5 years to be vested. And again, it's not 100% salary at all. I think it's roughly about 1.7% per year, I think is what it was. So if I had stayed 5 years, I would have gotten 10% of whatever the congressional salary
all right.
was,
so,
or the highest.
So 8 months doesn't set you for the rest of your life.
8 months, did absolutely nothing.
Now, you were a Democrat, and still are, I think. But,
yes,
if you had switched parties, quite likely you would have been able to do what Rodney Alexander did. You could have stayed there a long time. I'm sure people courted you to become a Republican. You chose to stay a Democrat. Any thoughts on maybe you should have switched to keep your job?
Well, you know, I tell you, it's funny. When I first ran for office in 99 for the state house, you know, I wasn't really Democrat, Republican, whatever, but you know, I got to see some of the policies that were enacted, some of the efforts by both sides, and I think that's what I am. I think I am a Democrat. I wanted to be a blue dog Democrat, which I was in Congress, a conservative Democrat. There are few and far between
fewer now.
I mean, they were decimated the cycle after my election. I think they went from 52 to 19, something of that nature, maybe 21. But so, no, I felt like the Democrats allowed me to be a little more reasonable, a little more flexible. I didn't find, at least Democrats here in the South are not as ideological. And, you know, I felt like that party allowed me to do what I thought was best for the constituency and the state and the country as a whole.
297-5633 for Don Cashew, Barry in Mid-City. Good morning, Barry. You're on the air with, I don't know whether to call him congressman or representative, but or U.S. attorney, but congressman is the post that is the highest that he held. So you're on with Congressman Cashew.
Yeah, Congressman Cashew, this is Barry Weinstein.
Oh, how you doing? How you doing?
I'm doing good, but we need you back in Congress. We need someone with your value system, your mores, your integrity to be in Congress as a strong Democrat. So come on. Why don't you run again?
Well, I appreciate it, Rabbi. That's a strong compliment. But there are some other great people out there, Democrat and Republican, I think, who share some of our values to try to help people. And at this point in my life, I'm not ready to step back in the arena. Maybe one day, but I think you have to have that in your gut and heart. And I just don't have that at this moment.
You went to Georgetown Law School, right?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
So you knew Washington a little bit. You weren't like Vance McAllister. He'd never been to Washington. As it turned out, he had other things on his mind, too. But you knew Washington, and you liked the city.
I loved when I was in law school in Georgetown. It was a very inspiring city. you can't go anywhere without seeing the monuments, to these great leaders and people who dedicated their lives to public service and just did just some extraordinary things to make our country great. So it was a very inspirational city, and I think that as much as anything sort of got me thinking about public service and politics.
Mm-hmm. But you're back home now, and as I said, it didn't take Don long to stay in public life. He became the U.S. attorney in this area, a man who knows the legal wheels pretty well in this state and elsewhere. In the 6th District, that's a much different district now than it was when you held it. For a Democrat, including the most prominent one who's running right now, Edwin Edwards, we've gone from like a 30% African-American district to a 20%. So that makes a huge difference as far as winning and losing.
Yes, sir. No, this district, the 6th District now, is much more Republican-leaning, and it was already that way. It was, I think President Obama got, I want to say 38% of the vote, not more than that either time. So I think in this particular configuration, he would probably get less, probably more like 28%.
Well, Charlie Cook lists it as the 24th most conservative district in the House of Representatives now. So it is a tough, tough district for a Democrat to win.
I didn't see that, but that doesn't surprise me.
And I say this knowing that I'll ruffle some feathers, but I think the only way Don Cashew would win in that district is if you switch parties.
I don't think a Democrat could win.
Including the former governor. Well, he's going to have a tough time.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Did you like serving in the Louisiana legislature?
I had more fun in the Louisiana legislature than I did in Congress, although, I didn't have long in Congress, so that's, it's kind of hard to compare. But the Louisiana legislature, at least then it was not partisan at all. So you got to work with people, and really the goal was to try to do what was right for the citizens of Louisiana and try to, confect bills and solutions that seemed reasonable. And I think we, at times we did that. It's never pretty, Jim. I mean, even during any, I don't want to wax too philosophically, because, certainly there were times that it, was not, pretty, but I do think it was a lot of fun. You got to use your mind, you use your skills with people. So it's I found it a real gratifying experience.
And you were there 8 years, and you left right as Bobby Jindal was arriving.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
He campaigned in a way that I think some people thought he wouldn't be a conservative governor, but you've watched it relatively closely, I'm sure. He has turned out to be what he campaigned as.
He's pretty conservative.
I would say so. I would say so. Now, he has an itch to go to Washington again as well. For you, it was to return to your old college days. For him, it's to return to his time in Congress. And actually, I guess he was leaving Congress as you were arriving, too.
So, that's correct.
So, yeah. So you're crisscrossing. But as President of the United States, when Governor Jindal takes the oath of office on January 20th, 2017, he will be appointing all the U.S. attorneys in America as the new president.
That's right.
That's one of the big duties of a new president.
That's right.
Obviously, there was something in your background that was attractive to President Obama.
Well, I was fortunate to be tapped for that. I had been a prosecutor on the state level, in Pointe-Coupee Parish, which is certainly not on the same level as these guys in East Baton Rouge in terms of what I did. Mm-hmm. I mean, I handled the misdemeanors and the felonies and even the appeals, but we just didn't have near the caseload as these guys here have, and got to try some good cases with my uncle John Wayne Jewell, who was also an assistant district attorney, and had a lot of fun doing that. And so I think that prosecutorial background combined with my own civil practice that I had subsequent or even during the time that I was an assistant DA, I think that that's what played a big part in getting the nod to become U.S. attorney.
But when a president comes in from another party, generally all the U.S. attorneys in the country are sent packing. Jim Letton was the notable exception, and it didn't take long for him to get sent packing for other reasons. But is that fair that, let's say, if Governor Jindal becomes President Jindal, all the Democrats who are U.S. attorneys now will be replaced by Republicans, I would think.
Jim, I have no problem with that. I mean, I think, there was another U.S. attorney in Baltimore who was also kept on, but and as well as in Chicago, as you know, as you probably remember. But, I don't have a problem with that. I think the president has certain policies. The Department of Justice is a big, important aspect of that policy, and also enforcing, whatever types of laws that he's, administrative laws and regulations that he's interested in. The good thing about the U.S. Attorney's Office is that all of the assistants are basically civil service, and so civil servants. So they are. They do not go out with each administration. At one time they did, and that was changed, and I think that was a good change. I think it's fine as long as you're not picking people who are there for political reasons. They don't have a political agenda, and that they are trying to do what's right. They're trying to secure justice. I mean, if that's your goal, and you have the credentials, I think. You can do well in that job.
But it's perhaps a byproduct of our system. Politics permeates everything in government, including the justice system.
Well, at times, I know that, the administration before this one sort of got a reputation for that. We met with the Attorney General several times, and as well as the President, and both were strong and were very adamant, in fact, about not being political, making sure we did things for the right reasons. And, with my background in politics, I think I went even further in terms of, making sure I didn't appear to be doing anything that had any type of political motive smell to it.
And what you said was that as the U.S. attorney, a lot of the people who work there, they're there through many administrations, so many of the people there were in that office before you arrived and are still.
Yes, sir. And very fine people. I tell this all the time to young lawyers. If you want to be a litigator, you can't learn more than at the U.S. Attorney's Office. And the men and women who serve in those offices are just fantastic, as well as the agencies and agents, who help us investigate.
297-5633, your number, Inkster Show at WRKF.org online. Back in 90 seconds with Don Cashew. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, 297-5633, 877-217-5757. Your numbers, Inkster Show at WRKF.org online. Don Cashew, 8 years in the Louisiana legislature, 8 months as a member of the U.S. House of Representatives, and then a few years as U.S. attorney before embarking on a career in private practice with a guy he served with in Baton Rouge at the U.S. Attorney's Office, former Assistant U.S. Attorney Lane Ewing. They are now with the Cashew Ewing Law Offices in Baton Rouge and in New Roads. And we're talking with Don Cashew about then and now. He won his congressional seat, by the way, by defeating a guy named Woody Jenkins, who has been around the political block a few times. You may have finally retired Woody Jenkins. I don't think he's run since.
I don't know. He's talked about it, and he's certainly still a leader, I believe, in the Republican
St. George thing.
Party and, yeah, in the St. George Initiative. And I think he's still very active.
He is indeed. And you were born on the 22nd birthday of Muhammad Ali and share the same birthday, same day, same year, January 17th, 1964, with the First Lady of the United States, Michelle Obama.
Yes, sir.
Who had great difficulty pronouncing your name.
That's a fact. Yeah, they did do a they tried. But
I imagine through the years you've been called a few different things.
Yeah, we had fun. That was actually a fun part of the campaign. It was, sort of making fun of my name. And, my daughters got to appear in the commercial, and they had a great time. And you can't take it too seriously when somebody messes up a name that's spelled like this. So.
Elizabeth asks about the partisan divide in Congress. Were you allowed to associate with Republicans when you were up there?
Well, I mean, again, I wasn't there that long. Rodney Alexander and I were friends from the legislature days, so I did see Rodney occasionally. Dr. Bustani, certainly we were cordial to each other. Steve Scalise and I had served together in the House, so we did do some things together. But the partisan divide is certainly strong, and I'm sure you've already read Kirby Goodell's book. I'm looking forward to reading that. I just bought it this weekend. So.
Well, it's a place where Democrats and Republicans no longer seem to work together. They seem to do everything they can to villainize the other side. In the old days, the Louisiana delegation would get together. Of course, at that time, it was largely Democratic, but the vow taken by members of the Louisiana delegation was that they would not speak ill of another member of the delegation. Here you have Landrieu and Cassidy, for example. They're saying a lot of nasty things about each other.
Well, I think that's a special. I would imagine they would have had an exception to the rule if one person decided to run against another person, although I guess that may not have happened back then.
Have you had any conversations with Bill Cassidy since he won?
Superficial. I'd see him in the airport a couple times, and we certainly, he's a nice guy. I like Congressman Cassidy, so we get along fine.
He is a nice guy, but a relentless politician, and he's a guy who came to it late, but seems to, at this point in his career, he's made all the right moves, and we'll find out if he made the right move running against Senator Landrieu. That shapes up as a tough battle, and one that I'm sure will create a lot of hostility around the state and perhaps between the two candidates.
Sure. I mean, it's a tough state for Democrats, but I think she's situated very, very well, as the chairman of the Commerce Committee.
On the Energy?
Energy and Commerce Committee. She's going to really be able to do a lot for Louisiana, for the oil and gas industry nationwide. So I just think that's going to neutralize the Democratic negatives that she has.
Now, as a prosecutor, you were involved in all kinds of things, murder cases. We've talked on this show with Kevin Kane, a noted conservative who's expressed concern, as have others, about the high rate of incarceration in Louisiana. We have more people on a proportional basis imprisoned in our state than anywhere else in the country. Is that a concern?
Well, I think the legislature has tried to address that in some ways. I don't know if it's been enough, but, to make sure that some of the nonviolent drug offenders were, not locked up for the rest of their lives, for instance. So I do think that's an effort. Anytime you make those changes, you got to be careful. You're not letting out people who are going to commit more crime. So, I think the reentry type programs that you're seeing both federally and on the state level, I believe, are helpful. And I think that's something that we probably ought to pay more attention to.
Well, you were involved in public corruption as the U.S. attorney. Some say the U.S. attorney in Baton Rouge is the most powerful person in the state because if you want to, you can call grand juries and have the governor and the governor's aides and a lot of other people coming before you. It seems that when you were there, you were somewhat judicious. I don't know how many grand jury proceedings there were because we don't get alerted as media people when that happens, but you were judicious in who got prosecuted and where you devoted your energies.
Well, having someone saying they are being investigated can be pretty strongly negative to their career. So we were certainly cautious in at least in terms of a grand jury subpoena. being issued. But, you know, that doesn't mean we, you know, weren't looking. And I say we weren't looking. I mean, the FBI is out there. And I want to say this. It's so impressive when you see some of these agents, FBI, ATF, DEA, Secret Service. I mean, extraordinary men and women, really smart people. And so they're, you know, they're out there looking, and I don't think anybody ought to feel like anybody's getting a free ride, because I think everybody's paying attention.
Do people still get target letters?
Yes, sir. Occasionally, yes. Yeah, that's probably not a good day.
I would imagine that's a day that would cause one to lose some sleep, and maybe a few other things. But
yes, sir.
So how does it read? You, Jim, are slated to report to a grand jury proceeding on a such and such date, and we have some questions for you.
It's really a target letter is more designed to get that person to go see an attorney, and so that attorney can call and say, hey, let's come in and see if there's a way to resolve this. And when I say resolve it, plead guilty to something, pretty quickly, and then start cooperating. That's the way the federal system works. There are guidelines that dictate the sentence range. I say dictate. Mm-hmm. It's their recommendations, but judges are pretty careful. They a lot of times they follow those guidelines, or at least keep them in mind. So the only way to deviate from those guidelines, to get those guidelines to go down, one of the only ways is cooperation, and that's one of the purposes of a target letter.
What are some of the most interesting cases you had as far as convictions, people who got these target letters and decided they either needed to go the distance or cop a plea?
Well, I would talk about the public corruption arena as well as the healthcare, Medicaid, Medicare fraud arena. But, from a personal standpoint, I got sworn in late June of 2010. I'm walking out the door. My criminal chief, Stan Lamell, who's now working with us, says, hey, we got to tell you about a case. And they, bring me in the back. My family's still there. They tell me about a case that involves all of the mayors, several mayors from my side of the river. When I say my side of the river, from the New Roads area. So that case certainly caught my attention and was probably from a public corruption standpoint, the biggest case as well.
Okay, so yeah, you knew the gentleman well.
I knew all of them, yes, sir.
Okay. But you go after, I remember a case involving credit card theft, hundreds of thousands of dollars of credit card theft. That's the kind of thing you go after as well.
Sure, identity theft is a big part of what the U.S. Attorney's offices do. Identity theft occurs even in these Medicare fraud cases. People will have their Social Security number stolen, and then they'll medical provider, the fraudster, will start billing the fraudster will start billing Medicare to the tune of sometimes millions of dollars.
Yeah. So now you're on the other side, though. Some of these people who get these target letters, I know if I got one, you might be the first guy I would call, former U.S. attorney. What do you do now if somebody wants representation?
Well, we certainly look at the case, and we look at all the facts and circumstances, and we try to advise them as to the best course of action. And most of the time, that means, going to the U.S. attorney's office and saying, look, we know he's done something wrong. Let's figure out how to make good, or make it better by cooperating and doing some things that could lessen the sentencing guidelines.
Mark Upton, the federal public defender, he emails me quite frequently. I imagine you talked with him a few times about cases.
We did, and we still do. Obviously, we did when we were. I did when I was a U.S. attorney, and now I pick his brain now that we're on this side as well. One thing that we're doing now, Jim, on this side, which is quite gratifying, is sort of in the same vein as the U.S. attorney, prosecution-wise, is the QI-TAM stuff. And QI-TAM cases allow a whistleblower basically to come in and say, hey, this fraud is going on. Let's go to the government and tell them about it, and that if there's any money recovered by the United States, mm-hmm. the whistleblower gets a certain percentage of that award.
297-5633, still time to get in with Don Cashew, former congressman, former state lawmaker, and former U.S. attorney. Charles on North Foster. Hello, Charles.
Good morning, Jim, and good morning, Mr. Cashew. I just wanted to know that I voted for him, and I wish he was still representing us in Washington, but my question
Hold on. I wanted to ask you, Charles, you voted for him instead of Michael Jackson?
Absolutely. I considered Michael Jackson a decoy. I still consider Michael Jackson a decoy. I think he was put in the election to split the African-American vote, and that's exactly what he did. Yeah, it's a disgrace.
Okay. What's your question?
But, Mr. Cashew, my concern is in targeting the black mayors, and I heard you mention that probe earlier, I was just amazed because here in Baton Rouge, we had a hospital right here, Earl K. Long, with about $280 million in annual revenue from the state that was basically given away under no-bid circumstances. And the first thing I realized was this is perfectly a RICO case. We had Woman's Hospital on Airline Highway, which is almost still sitting empty. It could have been moved there. So,
all right. What about people like Charles who say you ought to look into this? What do you do in a case like that?
Well, Charles, I appreciate your concern about the mayor's cases. They were not targeted, first of all. A concerned citizen actually went to the FBI, talked to him about one of the mayors trying to shake him down, frankly. And that just opened up a big investigation, and unfortunately, we discovered some corruption, and they had to be prosecuted. I mean, I say unfortunately because it's sad to me that these guys did what they did. In terms of, I'm certainly not going to comment on a particular case, but you know, the way a lot of these cases are made, Charles, is the FBI and the U.S. Attorney's Office and the investigators, they do read the newspaper. And so if there's something that smells bad, they do look at it. And sometimes it actually goes into a full-blown grand jury investigation. Sometimes it doesn't. But because somebody's not indicted doesn't mean that case wasn't looked at. And I promise you, I'm not talking at all about what you just mentioned. I don't know anything about that, so I wouldn't be able to comment.
But sometimes you do convene a grand jury, you do hear testimony, and you decide not to prosecute based on the evidence that is presented.
That's right. Most of the time, though, Jim, you can figure it out before convening a grand jury. I mean, there are enough documents. Sometimes you have to have a grand jury to talk to some witnesses, but there's usually a paper trail, and there are other witnesses out there that you can talk to without actually convening a grand jury. So there are ways to investigate without going into a full-blown grand jury investigation.
What's that old saying about a good prosecutor can indict a ham sandwich with a grand jury? Is that the case?
Well, I do think that, you know, grand juries certainly are amenable to listening to the prosecutor, but I encourage anybody who gets a grand jury summons. I'm talking about a summons to become a grand juror, or to be a juror in a civil or criminal trial. I encourage them to do that because I think people who do that actually come out with a better appreciation and a better mm-hmm. sense of what the system is about, yeah. and actually enjoy doing what they're doing.
Yeah, it wouldn't be a good idea to ignore a target letter.
I didn't mean a target letter.
But if a person goes before a grand jury as a target, can he bring an attorney?
Not in the grand jury room. No, sir.
No. So you take your chances. What happens if the person says, look, I just don't want to, I don't want to do it?
Well, I mean, you know, you have certain constitutional rights, but the government can compel testimony if the person is given immunity. I mean, you have to go through some steps to accomplish that.
How do you make the call on immunity?
Well, immunity is, I mean, yeah, that's a broad decision. You know, when we have some great criminal chiefs, assistant mm-hmm. U.S. attorneys there that help guide those type decisions. And so I certainly was informed very significantly by their insight.
Well, we're glad you're still in the legal game, and you got quite a staff with Lane Ewing, the former assistant U.S. attorney, and Stan Lamell.
Yes, sir. Stan's and Lane are both great guys.
So they're together and handling all kinds of cases, and we're glad you're still around, and hopefully you'll be back with us again soon.
Thank you, Jim.
Thank you, Don Cashew, fine man and former congressman who did not get a pension for his 8 months on Capitol Hill. Until tomorrow, I'm Jim Engster. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.